Welcome back to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's time to talk about the history of the world's greatest race and racing facility. It's the talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Sunshine in our eyes. Another beautiful day on the west side of Indianapolis. The track opens again tomorrow morning at 10. Practice available from noon until 6. Hello, Donald. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. Very good. Thank you.
Let's get to it at 317-239-1070 is our telephone number, and we're going to start with Jeff in Joliet, Illinois. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Donald. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Jeff. What you got?
I'd like you to talk about somebody that's kind of critical, but I think is a really good ambassador to the sport, and that's Robin Miller.
Okay. You want me to profile Robin Miller?
Very cool. I think this is our first profile of Robin.
That's what I thought, too. Maybe talk about his early days at the Speedway and his short driving career.
I don't know which should come first. The first time I was aware of Robin, I think, was probably about 1970. And probably not everybody. I mean, at one time, he had quite a few detractors. I think that's gone away now. At one time, he was, I don't know, polarizing, I suppose, would be the comment. But when I first knew about Robin, he'd actually been a crew member for Jim Herdebees in 1968. Didn't meet him then. I think the first time I was aware of him was about 1970, as I say. And Bob Collins had hired him on the Star Sports staff. And I found his writing to be dazzling. And that has remained. Some of his leads, I think, are fantastic. And a lot of people would say, oh, he doesn't know how to write. Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. You may not like the content.
Exactly.
But he can write. And I remember thinking, because I think he was like about 19 or 20 when I was first reading his stuff and talking to him a little bit. And I remember thinking, this guy's really good, and he's going to burn himself out. And I just thought, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, you say, whatever happened to that kid? He was really good. But by golly, he persevered. And still, it's just astonishing to me how somebody like that can sit down and write a piece that quickly. I enjoy writing, but it's a struggle for me. And, it's supposed to be about Robin, not me. Apparently fell in love with the Speedway, or at least I know there was a. He says that he had an opportunity to go on a field trip to either Washington D.C. or the track. I think was the choice, as I recall, and so he chose the track, and that was back in the days of the old museum in the single-story brick that was on the corner of 16th and Georgetown in those days. I know that he idolized Herdebees, and he was a crew member for Herdebees during practice, and I think qualifications. I'm not sure if he made the call shot or not. No, he might not have been hired back for qualifications, but I know he was out here during practice.
He jokes that he got fired a lot.
Well, what happened? I do remember this one thing that Herdebees had. How was this now? There was something to do where he would put the goggles on. And then I think he put tape over the goggles so that they would remain in place. There was something like that. And so Herdebees for a practice run one day. And how was it now that they took the helmet off and the head sock? And I think it was the goggles, but I'm not sure. But anyway, I do know that it involved plaster being stuck to Herdebees' cheek and coming off in a rather painful way. I do recall that. And then I think maybe he wasn't invited back, so I don't remember if he's in the qualifying shot or not. And had he been, it was certainly a historical occasion, because that's the last time a front-engine car was ever in the race. And so, let's see. I think he was asked to leave the Star and then hired back and then stayed for a while there and then became the most read motorsports journalist in the country, perhaps, because I know that when he was writing for the Star, And he wrote some just, you know, really scathing reviews on certain things he didn't agree with. And he took a lot of people to task. And that was a rather difficult period. But there's no doubt that everybody was reading it. And whenever he did a story, and this was, I don't even know if these things were being posted online. I mean, I live in the dark ages, so I just remember reading newspapers. But I know that whenever a Robin article came out, I mean, everybody across the country was reading it, and the fax machines were going crazy as it was being shared with teams and so forth. He had his issues with some of the participants, some of the well-known participants, but he had a way of winning them over. And he was exceedingly generous. I think a lot of people didn't understand that he was a very caring person. And so he was loud and boisterous and everything. But if a driver was injured or was hospitalized or something like that, he'd be the first one to go and visit them. There were some that liked certain types of ice cream, so he would take them ice cream. He would buy a lot of gifts. He spent a lot of money at Christmas time to buy books and stuff like that for the racers. And then he would host these dinners for some of the greatest names that ever lived. And they would all be Robin cronies. He just had a way of winning them over. I mean, he and Foyt, you know, weren't getting along terribly well at one time. Well, now, you know, Robin can get Foyt on the phone at any time. And he just seemed to earn the respect of the people. As far as the driving career is concerned, he ran SCCA just a little bit. He had a Lotus. Was it like a Lotus Elan or something? I'm showing my ignorance here, but it was a Lotus.
Like a Formula Ford type?
No, this was a hardtop. Okay. And I don't know if he did open wheel.
I believe he told me he had a open wheel car, Formula Ford, very, very briefly, and got out of that pretty quickly.
I don't remember that. I just remember him banging around Raceway Park in a sports car. So in fact, I was actually riding with him. And then he bought a USAC midget from Bettenhausen's. And ran that for, maybe a couple of years. And it gave it the college try. He made a feature occasionally, but never running at the front. But by golly, he was out there and doing it. And so the fact that he would hang with these short track guys and have lunch with them and so on and so forth, but then he would go, and the very fact that he would participate in a hot lap session, I mean, that took commitment, and he was really serious about it. And then I think maybe 2 or 3 years was about it. He did get hurt once. I think it was at Santa Fe, Hinsdale, Illinois, I think is where he did get his bell rung and got beaten up a little bit. So eventually he decided to retire. But he seems to like he matured in some ways, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. It just seemed that he settled down some, but not really.
Still
and
eats
then,
the same way as he did when he was 17 years old.
Yeah.
Hot dogs and candy and Pepsi.
Oh, absolutely. But then they got into television commentary, and then I'm not sure if he created the pit walk, but he was one of the. He probably has done it about as well as anybody, and I marvel at it when I've seen him do it, and maybe not a lot of people would understand what that entails, but when you set off, and you've got the headset, you've probably got a producer talking to you, which you well know, and you've got the microphone, and you've got the cameraman running behind you. And the very fact that you can zigzag in and out of all these people and then see somebody that you want to talk to and then have a couple of decent questions for them or kid with them a little bit, that is an art that's hard to explain. And the very fact that he's got a producer telling him, you know, get out of it in 45 seconds or so, so whatever it might be. I just think it's just phenomenal. And the fact that when you see the looks on the faces of the people when he comes up to them, they smile. It's not like they think, oh, there's that guy again. Mm-hmm. Because he's taken the trouble to hang out with them. And the fact that he would do all of these lunches and that he doesn't just sort of show up at the track and then expect to get to the interviews. He's befriended these people. And then beyond that, and this is another art, I think, when you hang out with the racers, to be able to interview them, do your job as a reporter, but at the same time not betray them with confidences. And I think he's done a remarkable job of that. So I was saddened when he was so outspoken circa 1996, 1997, 1998. That hurt a little bit. But I still had great respect for him, and I still do.
As far as the pit walk, I think we somewhat borrowed that from Formula One. That goes back to, you know, I can recall seeing Peter Windsor do that, Derek Daly, and others. But I think that he helped bring it to American motorsports. And I'll tell you the backstory of how we eventually got that on the NBCSN broadcasts. Robin and I joined the broadcasts at the same time in 2011. I had worked a few races for them before filling in, and it was actually Versus at the time. And Robin had pitched that idea of a grid walk very early on, and, well, we'll think about it. Mm-hmm. We're not sure if we're going to do that, and it was put on hold. And how it eventually got going was Dan Weldon. When Dan Weldon joined our broadcasts, I think his first one was right after he won the 500 at Texas. We already had him lined up to work because he didn't have a full-time ride, and he was going to come on at Texas. And in our first conference call, and Dan was taking this very seriously. For a current driver, he went all in, and he was very engaged in our meetings and our conference calls. And he asked, why can't we do a type of a grid walk? And when the Indianapolis 500 winner from a week ago makes a suggestion, it's listened to a lot more, and that got it done. And he and Dan, Robin and Dan, both did it. One started at one end and the other at the other end. So we give a lot of credit, we still do, for Dan giving us that idea and getting that up and rolling.
I'll just say
it has continued.
I'll just say that Robin didn't so much as a pit walk as a pit run. Because, I mean, he would actually jog. but just the fact that he could think on his feet like that, and I'll just say, if anybody thinks that's easy, you try it and you find out it's not.
And for those that are just racing fans, Robin was the sports columnist for the Indianapolis Star for many years.
That.
So it wasn't just motorsports. He was the preeminent voice in this town on the Colts, on the Pacers, and everything else for many, many years. Thank you for the question. More coming up for Donald in just a moment from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, 107-1070 The Fan. It's the Talking Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Thanks for joining us this evening. Donald Davidson is here. I'm Kevin Lee, and joining us next from Michigan, Mark is with us. Hi, Mark. You're up with Donald.
Hello, Donald.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question regarding Jim Clark.
Yes?
Now, 1965 was when it was his 500 win. And also that was one that was the year that he was world driving champion. So he simultaneously held both those titles. And I know in early twenties there was a driver I believe that ran the only Grand Prix. Jimmy Murphy won it, and he came back and won the 500. My question is there any other? I know he wasn't crowned the world driving champion. Jimmy Murphy wasn't, but. A mythical, I guess. Well, my question I'm getting at is that is there anybody else has done that or come close to holding simultaneously those two titles?
I'm not sure I quite understand your question, but to clarify a couple of things.
I think he's asking world champion and winning the 500 in the same year.
In the same year, Jimmy Murphy won the French Grand Prix. And by that time, there was a second Grand Prix. There was no World Championship of Drivers. But for the first several years, the French Grand Prix, it was actually the Grand Prix. And then clarified later as the French Grand Prix when they added the Italian. And Jimmy Murphy did win that in 21 and came back and won Indianapolis 500 the next year. But for people who, if your question is people who won the World Championship and then won the 500 as the defending world champion, is that what you're asking?
Sure, that's what I'm going to ask.
Oh, all right then. Okay.
Or won it in the same year or the next year?
Yeah. Well, then Jim Clark would be one, but winning the Indianapolis 500 in 65 and then the World Championship later that year. And
so I guess we could ask it a couple of different ways. So really it would be who won the World Championship, if any, the year before, so they come to Indy like Nigel Mansell did and didn't win the 500 but came close as the reigning world champion.
I would say that hasn't happened. We've had 12 world champions drive in the 500. In other words, and to clarify that, there's 12 people that drove in the Indianapolis 500 at some point in their career and won the world championship at some point in their career. In fact, we could probably run through all of them if you like. But the first one would be Alberto Ascari, who came to Indianapolis in 1952, but hadn't won the world championship yet. That came that year. Ascari was the world champion in 52 and 53. So when he drove at Indianapolis in 52, he had not yet won the world championship. The defending world champion who drove in the 500 was Jack Brabham, world champion in 59 and 60, and then drove in the 500 in 61. And then Jim Clark in 63 had not won the world championship, but he drove in 63, finished second, and won the world championship that year. And then we've got I've been playing around with this quite a bit and asked it quite a bit. It's difficult because you've got to do several calculations in your mind. So in probably in no particular order, in 66 you've got Graham Hill, had already won the world championship in 62, and would win it again in 68. His teammate was Jackie Stewart, who had not yet won the world championship, but would go on to win it three times, 69, 71, and 73. And then, let's see, we've got Dennis Holm. That's an interesting one. He was obviously driving Grand Prix, came here in 67 as a rookie, finished fourth, won the world championship that year, and then came back and finished fourth again as the defending world champion. And then there's Jochen Rindt, who drove in 67 and 68 and then won the world championship actually posthumously in 1970. And then there's Mario Andretti, who drove in the 500 a bunch of times and then won the world championship in 1978. And then there's Emerson Fittipaldi, was the world champion in 72 and 74 and comes to Indianapolis for the first 1984, which was like a second career. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't immediately come over. He actually was sort of on hiatus for a couple of years and just running go-karts and an occasional sports car race. And let's see. Then we've got Nelson Piquet. In 1993, he actually was here in 92, crashed heavily in practice, came back in 1993 and made the race. But with all of the attention that he was getting in 92, in 93, it's almost like he slipped in and out the back door and nobody knew that he was here. He did drive
because
for Menard.
Of someone else that was here.
Well, that's that's true. But it was not a spectacular qualifying run in terms of being up the front. And he had a mechanical problem early on and finished 32nd. And so I think a lot of people, they remember Piquet was here and crashed in 92.
Yep.
I think a lot of people probably don't realize that he did come back and drive in the race. But, yes, the attention, all of the attention for 92 went to Nigel Mansell, who was the defending world champion and came here. And actually led the race late and then got snookered on a restart by Ray Hall and Ari Leyendyke and ended up third. And then we've got Jacques Villeneuve, who was here in 94 and 95 and finished second and first and then went to Europe, and then was second in the World Championship in 96 and first in 97. And so that's amazing how he was able to, you know, that was four pretty spectacular years. And then, let's see, I wasn't counting up, so did I miss somebody? The drivers who have won the World Championship and the Indianapolis 500 at some point in their career, there's five of those, and it is Jim Clark, Graham Hill, Emerson Fittipaldi,
and I've got the
Jacques
other two.
Villeneuve, yep. and then Mario. If I didn't say Mario, okay, that's the five. And so you've got seven that won the World Championship, ran in the 500 and didn't win, and that would be Alberto Ascari, Dennis Hulme, Nelson Piquet, Nigel Mansell. Here I am painting myself into a corner again. Jochen Rindt, Jackie Stewart, and I need one more.
I think I have it.
Okay.
I don't think you said Jack Brabham again.
I did not.
But you did earlier.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that's the seventh.
That adds up to 12.
Because, I was doing it the hard way. But I'll say once again, in order to answer this question technically correct, because people can nitpick, and that's fine. But there's some of these things where there's a lot of good opportunities for nitpicking, and I've always tried to cover all the bases, and sometimes get myself in trouble when I try to do that.
So this one has come up this year. We have a pair of Formula One race winners. We have several that have raced in Formula One, but we have two with Fernando Alonso and Juan Pablo Montoya. Montoya, won 11 Formula One races. So we have. Two, I may be off on that. That may not be right. Maybe
that
it's 10.
Sounds high. I know he won the Italian Grand Prix.
I'll look it up in a second. But okay. The question then came up, when's the last time that happened? And it's not that long since we had race winners, two Formula One race winners in the 500.
Rubens Barrichello and Jean Alesi.
And also Jacques Villeneuve was in the 500 in 2014.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, and Alesi was not in the race that year. So that year it would have been... Montoya and Villeneuve and Barrichello. I'd have to look up and see what year Barrichello was in the race. Maybe 13? 12? 2012. And that was the year that John Alesi was in the race, I believe. So those were the two race winners that were. And I think you're right. You know what? I think I was thinking of Barrichello may have won 11 Formula One races.
That would be right.
And I think Montoya may have only won 7.
I remember that being – I've just got the Italian Grand Prix in mind, and I didn't remember him winning that many.
I'll have that on my notes here. In the meantime, thank you for the call, Mark. Let's sneak in next. He just hung up. So that moves Charles to the right to the top of the line. Hi, Charles. Open phone lines now, by the way, 239-1070.
Hi,
you're
Charles.
Up with Donald.
Hey, Mr. Donald.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I went to school with a Janine Rasmussen. We were all Decatur Central kids.
You went to school with who?
We were all race kids growing up, but I never knew anything about her dad. Now, I know her dad is Elvin Rasmussen. And I'm wondering if you can give me just a little bit of information, because I never met the man ever in my life.
All right. Well, that would be easily done, because he hangs out here. So just come over and go to the plaza area, go to where the old timers hang out, and you'll see Eldon. Eldon is a Canadian. I don't know if he ever took a citizenship. He may still be a national. He was born in Edmonton, Alberta, to American parents, but he's Canadian born. And so as far as citizenship, I'm not clear on that. We just think of him as a Canadian. And his 500 starts were 1975, 1977, and 1979. And he was there in other years. 1974, he was one of the cars that was stuck in line when that was a whole situation I really don't want to get into a great deal, but because of the energy crunch, there was only two qualifying days, two consecutive Saturdays. And when qualifying ended at 6 o'clock on the second Saturday, several cars that were stuck in line, and whether or not they should have had an opportunity to go out is up for discussion, except that they didn't, so it doesn't matter. And one of the ones that was stuck in line. So 1975, he came back and qualified for the race. In fact, he built his own. The car was called a Rascar. Eldon was a great fabricator and did a lot of work for a lot of people on other Indianapolis cars, but also for drag races. And so drag racing teams would hang out. And I remember Gary Back. His operation would pretty much, I think, was headquartered at Eldon's place out near Stout Field. Anyway, it was the Anacomp Wild Rose Special was the name of his car in 1975. And unfortunately, there was a coming together, a bumping of wheels involving Tom Sneaver, who ended up crashing quite spectacularly in turn two and got out of it with no injury. But the two of them went back quite a way because Eldon actually had run in an organization called the Canadian American Modified Racing Association, which, known as CAMRA. Anyway, I need to probably move the thing along here a little bit. In 1976, that was a heartbreaker. He qualified and got bumped and was the first alternate starter. And that one still bothers me today when somebody like that, that's got all this involved and you get bumped and you're the first alternate starter. In 1977, he finished in 13th. And then we'll jump to 1979, which was his final start. And he was given 23rd in that. He didn't finish. But a great fabricator. I could tell you a lot of other. He had an involvement with a company called Rent-A-Racer, where there was a drive-it-yourself thing, not go-karts, but they were actually like mini race cars, up at 52nd and Lafayette Road approximately. I might be off a block or two. But anyway, Eldon built all of the cars that were in that short-lived venture. But anyway, he's still around. Fascinating guy. Lots of great stories.
Thank you, Charles. I looked it up to confirm. Montoya did win F1 races. He won Monaco in 2003, was one of them. So I have some faculties remaining. So
I think he was fourth in points, was his highest point.
Third a couple of times.
In points?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
According to what I'm looking
at. All right,
I've
got to get up to brush up on my Formula 1.
Well, you're not tasked with knowing that. That's
casual. I do the 50s. I'm pretty good on that still, I think.
Well, some would say Juan's been around for a while, but not nearly that long. All right, more of your questions for Donald coming up here on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Right back at it on the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway from one of my employer's headquarters, NBC, is located in Stamford, Connecticut, and that's where Raymond joins us. Hi, Raymond.
Hi, how are you guys doing tonight?
Okay, Raymond.
Hi, my question is about a driver by the name of Ray Howard.
Yes. Okay.
Just yep. Like to know about his career and what he did and after.
Oh, okay.
After Indy.
I don't know what he did after, but he ran in 1919 and 1920, and he had a French Peugeot. And that's probably about all I can tell you. So I rather think that he was probably came from a fairly well-to-do family because I think he owned his own car, and it was a French Grand Prix Peugeot. And that's probably about all I can tell you about him. I don't know. I can't tell you off the top of my head when he may have passed away. I think that he did come back to visit, like, even before the formation of the Old Timers Club. I think he was one of those people that would come back, like, in the late 40s, early 50s to visit, just to be here.
Okay.
So that's a short one, but that's about all I can tell you. I know what he looks like. A very you know, nicely groomed mustache. I mean, he looked like he was a leading man in the movies. Very right. debonair looking fellow.
Thank you, Raymond. Good to hear okay. from you. Kyle is next in Anderson, Indiana. Hi, Kyle.
How are we doing, guys?
Fine, thanks.
Great.
What's up?
Good. I want to, curious with Rossi running out of fuel last year and coasting under the checkered flag, where yeah. his lap speed ranks in the modern era.
Well, the final lap speed was I don't remember what it was now. But
was it
I
like 150?
Something like that, yes. I think there was sort of like 50 or 60 mile an hour differential between first and second. But I'll say something about Rossi that I don't think I'd realize until somebody pointed it out to me. He actually had the fastest lap of the race.
Yes, he did.
Which I think was like lap 98 or something like that. But I don't know that I've seen what the last the average speed for the final lap was.
And even if we did, you know a lot of things, but you're not going to know lap speeds throughout the years.
Oh, well, I probably should have noted that one. I just know that I still can't believe that it was 179 we're hearing in our ear, and as opposed to I don't know. Everybody, I think, was kind of slowing down because they were all – Munoz was yeah. closing, but I don't know what his last lap might have been. I mean, I'm just going to guess 210 or something like that, perhaps.
Yeah,
just a guess.
Maybe even higher if he wasn't saving fuel yeah. at that point. So yeah. we've had others that had to save fuel, but as far as the winner is concerned, mm-hmm. yeah, you'd have to go quite a ways back.
To have somebody that had a last lap at 178?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm trying to think if Dan Weldon was saving. I don't think he was saving in 2011. J.R. Hildebrand was saving.
Yeah.
So I can't recall anyone having a huge fuel issue where it finished under green. There were a couple that got maybe bailed out by a late yellow.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you're going to go back to the 70s.
Probably.
The 70s,
yeah.
something like that. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Cole. Thank you, Kyle. 239-1070 is the number, and Trevor is next in Evansville. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Trevor.
How's it going, guys?
Fine, thank you. What's up?
I have a quick question about Art Pollard in 1972. So
yes.
he qualified the car, and he broke his leg in practice afterwards. And
correct.
Wally Dallenbach took over the car. Has there ever been another time where the driver and the car that qualified did not race on race day?
With the car, because I think they replaced the tub. I don't recall how that worked out. I know they tried. They were going to have to start last anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, I don't recall if they were able to repair the tub or if they got another one of the same type and substituted that. I don't recall. But so your question is that
a replacement car and a replacement driver.
A replacement car and a replacement driver. Golly. I can think of drivers that started last in a car that they hadn't qualified because they were allowed to substitute it. Tom Sneva did that in 1980. I think Fittipaldi did that. I think he crashed a car they couldn't repair, and so he started last.
There's probably some other ones.
Probably.
Where, you know, for example, did they repair Scott Brayton's car? I don't know.
Well, the car that Brayton crashed was not the car that he qualified.
I think that was a backup car.
So I think the car that Ongais drove was the one that Brayton had qualified, as I recall.
Okay.
There's probably, yeah, I wouldn't say there hasn't been, because the rules have changed now I remember in 1980, the fact that Tom Sneva had crashed a car and was able to substitute another car of a different type. Because the car that he crashed, it was the only one of its type at the track. I remember that being a rule that I don't think was meant for Indianapolis. That was meant for like Milwaukee or somewhere like that. So It seems to me that there was an occasion where neither the car nor the driver had qualified. But maybe I was just thinking when we were doing hypotheticals at one time.
Hmm.
What
okay.
ifs?
Trevor, thank you. Donald, you'll have that at 9:15 tonight, right?
Yes.
If it has happened, you'll have it at 9:15, and you'll share it tomorrow night on the show.
We're off in areas that I'm not very comfortable with. I'd rather be talking about people.
More in a moment with Donald. Stay with us. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 1070 The Fan. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Which line are we going to next for Donald Davidson? I have some of the questions. Donald does not, so we support him. And Davis is next with the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Hi, Davis.
Hey, good evening, Kevin. Good evening, Donald. How are you doing tonight?
How are you? Good,
yes,
thank you.
I just got one simple question tonight. Has any driver ever picked a chocolate milk when they won the Indy 500?
No. No.
But have some have put it on the list and not have won. Is that right?
I don't know if it's still offered, but at one time it was.
Yeah, that's what I knew. They have buttermilk, white milk, 2% chocolate, correct?
And David says it's not offered anymore.
So
it was at one time.
We had the people from American Dairy Association in with Grady and Joe either last year or the year before, and they talked about how chocolate milk is not an option for the drivers if they win the Indy 500.
I thought it was at one point, just for a couple of years, I
thought
think.
So, too. At one point, I've seen the list of what they choose.
Yes.
But I think I've heard along those lines that it's not – as photogenic, and you know, now it's become tradition to dump it on your head, and the white is going to look a little bit better.
Good point. Yep.
So, there you go. Thanks, Davis. Kevin is next here in Indianapolis. Hi, Kevin. You're on with Donald.
Hi, Donald. I just wanted you to talk about Salt Walter's crash. I was a big fan of his and just his career at the 500.
Well, I don't particularly want to talk about his crash, but he had one in 1973. Salt actually had a top 10 finish. He was ninth in 1976. Admittedly, that was a race that was stopped because of rain. But he was in the 1972 race, qualified at the last minute. In fact, the car that he was in... got out of at the last minute. This teammate was Bud Tinglestad, and Tinglestad was kind enough to step aside and let Salt go out and qualify, and it was pretty spectacular, but all for naught, because when they came down for the start, he pulled off into the first turn grass and never completed a lap, and then came back the next year, and then came down in 1973, which is one that we'd all probably rather forget. And he was involved in a multiple accident, and so he was in the rather unusual situation of having driven in the Indianapolis 500 twice and never made it to turn two. But he did receive pretty severe injuries, and he was in the burn center at Ann Arbor for quite some time. But he made the comeback, and I think a lot of people, whatever they thought about Salt. I thought he was one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. But I think a lot of people kind of it opened their eyes when he came back in 1974 and then did qualify. In 1975, Bob Harkey drove the second car. And the arrangement with Harkey qualifying the second car was that if anything happens to Salt... his car, we're going to you in, Bob Harkey, and then Salt's going to take over for you. And that actually happened. Salt was the first one out in 1975. So his first four starts, he was 33rd three times. But what the records don't normally show, or typically the box score will only show the starting driver, Salt took over the Bob Harkey car, and that was running 10th when the race was stopped at 174 laps because of rain. I do remember this just like it was yesterday, being in the master control tower and then seeing that when Salt very, very animated fashion, signaled to the crew to bring Harkey in. And I could see their sort of arms outspread as if they were saying, "You really mean it now?" And he was quite adamantly, he put his, he did this like a semicircular motion with his arm and pointed the finger down as if to say, "Bring him in now." And so in came Harkey. He gets out, Salt gets in, and this is all under green. And by the time the, you know, he got going again, obviously they lost quite a bit of time. And I just think that although it ended up Bob Harkey with Salt Walter in relief finished 10th, had they waited until the first pit stop, they probably could have maybe finished 6th. But Salt was calling the shots. Anyway, he did get the 9th in 1976, as I said, and was away for several years. 1979 was the last year that he was here for a while, and then he came back in 1990. And after all those years, and he almost made it, and he ended up as the first alternate starter. And unfortunately, he's deceased now, and probably as the result of the injuries, was seeking medication a lot of the time and got himself in trouble and was the guest of the government. But I tell you what, a more charismatic guy I don't have ever met. And when he'd been away for quite some time, and somebody said, "Hey, Salt Walter's in the garage area today." And I remember that I was sort of looking out for him, and I didn't see him, but I heard the voice. And when you saw him, he looked quite a bit different. But by golly, that voice and the whole demeanor was the same. He was a great guy. A lot of people didn't care for him, but by golly, he went out there and did it and drove in the Indianapolis 500 several times.
Thank you for the question, Kevin.
Yeah, I met him out there like in 2008 when he came out there, like when you was talking about. I got to see him that day.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Well, I think about him as I say, he's kind of met a sad end, but a good guy, I think.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
That's all of our time for tonight. Donald, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Kevin.
We'll do it again tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Oh, I wanted to mention this. I need to start mentioning this. During our coverage on IMS Radio this weekend, you are going to be as a part of the coverage. And if we ever hit a lull, that's set up an email address.
Yeah.
And I think it's askdonald@brickyard.com.
Yeah.
I would not advise sending it unless you're actually listening, because who knows when these questions will be answered. But if you're listening to our coverage that will air here on 107.5, 1070 The Fan, or on the internet this weekend, when we hit a slower spot, there's going to be an opportunity like we used to do during slow spots during qualifying. You'll be in the booth with Mark Janes, and you'll be able to answer questions via email.
Happy questions, please. Happy questions.
Well, here's the thing. It's why I like to do email questions sometimes. It's really easy.
If it's controversial, don't go there.
It's really easy to screen them, and I pick the questions that I most want to do.
All right, very good.
So we'll remind people of that on Friday night, but keep that in mind if you haven't had a chance to get your question through to Donald. And we're going to do some email questions next week on the show. A couple of shows, definitely Tuesday and Thursday, are going to be all emails. If you've tweeted questions for Donald, you should email them to me at kevin@1070thefan.com, because they get lost in the shuffle on Twitter. Thank you, Donald. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Thank you, Kevin.
Also tomorrow night at 7 o'clock as well. Thanks to Charlene Birdsong, our on-site engineer, and David Deering back in the studio. Thanks so much for being a part of our evening here on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.